morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Thursday, January the 6th. And here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. UN Horn of Africa envoy Jeffrey Feltman will visit Ethiopia today for meetings with senior government officials to discuss peace talks. This is Feltman's final trip to the region as he prepares to step down from his role.
Well, I'm sure he would probably say that he's not entirely satisfied with the conditions that he's leaving his portfolio in.
That is Cameron Hudson with the Atlantic Council's Africa Center. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says a scathing report by an inquiry into statecraft marks the end of an era of corruption.
Now people want to see consequences and accountability. People are losing trust in government and in democracy.
That is Nania Bola Mueller, a professor with South Africa's Human Sciences Research Council. And Cameroon has deployed troops and armored cars to towns that will be hosting matches of the Africa Football Cup of Nations tournament in its troubled southwest region. We'll have those stories and more coming out right here on Daybreak Africa. And for our top story, the U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, will step down from his post this month after more than 9 months on the job. Feltman assumed the position in April of 2021 amid two major crises, Ethiopia's civil war between the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, and Ethiopia's National Army, as well as a military coup in Sudan in October. As he winds down his role, Feltman will visit Ethiopia today, Thursday, for meetings with senior government officials to discuss peace talks. It has been reported that the outgoing ambassador to Turkey, David Satterfield, will be replacing Feltman as the new special envoy to the region. Cameron Hudson is a non-resident senior fellow with the Atlantic Council's Africa Center. He tells me that the U.S. still has substantial leverage when it comes to putting pressure on the stakeholders in the crisis in Ethiopia and Sudan.
What does Feltman's departure say about efforts to bring peace to the Horn of Africa? What would you say have been his main achievements, given that the war is still ongoing in Ethiopia?
Well, I'm sure he would probably say that he's not entirely satisfied with the conditions that he's leaving his portfolio in, because you're right, the conflict in Ethiopia is still very much going on, although perhaps there's a new opening for some kind of ceasefire to emerge right now, given the withdrawal of Tigrayan forces out of Amhara and Afar. But I think that he leaves a mixed legacy, quite frankly. But I think, you know, to be fair, this is the first time we've ever had an envoy to the Horn of Africa region. He came into the job before we had an assistant secretary, so before many of the key roles in the administration had been filled out. So he was very much, I think, came in as a stopgap to provide some leadership and some diplomatic engagement at a time when the Biden administration very early on was still filling out its team. So I think it's fair to say he did not have a full support system around him when he came into the job. And so I think he has filled out that. He has gotten, I think, the administration off to a reasonably good start, but clearly there's a lot more work to be done.
Ambassador David Satterfield, who is a former ambassador to Turkey, will be replacing Feltman. What does that tell you about the Biden administration's commitment or efforts to bring peace to this region?
Well, I think it is a good suggestion that they take it seriously, that they understand that there is an unfinished job to be done. I think it also, hopefully, is a recognition of the fact that we don't have proper diplomatic recognition in the region. We don't have an ambassador in Somalia presently. We don't have an ambassador in Sudan. And so if you're not going to have ambassadorial level representation on the ground, then you absolutely need some kind of envoy, I think, if there are crisis situations as they are in the Horn of Africa right now. So I think it's a good recognition on their part that we cannot afford to leave a diplomatic vacuum at this critical moment.
Now, in Sudan, protests have continued for 2 weeks, for weeks actually, even after the resignation of Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok. The military leaders in the country are not budging to this internal pressure. How does the new envoy approach this situation, and what kind of leverage does the U.S. have to, you know, put pressure to the military?
Well, I think the first thing that a new envoy needs to do is make sure that he has Washington behind him. And so I think he would be well served to spend some time on Capitol Hill and in Washington with the administration, making sure that he has both a very coherent set of policy objectives and that he has the backing and the tools that he needs in order to go carry out that mission. I think that's one of the, you know, criticisms that we can make of the administration thus far is, you know, you have Congress taking a much more aggressive line in a place like Sudan than even the administration. And across the administration, you're seeing very different messages. You're seeing much more of an accommodating message of the military coming from the State Department, whereas USAID under Samantha Power or USUN under Linda Thomas Greenfield really taking a much harder line against the military. And so I think we need to have a policy that is better managed than it has been thus far. I think it's a question as to whether or not the envoy can do that, but he also has to understand what tools we do have.
And how would he exercise that leverage?
And I think the United States, to your point about leverage, has substantial leverage that we can bring to bear in Sudan, but we haven't thus far. So we're talking about targeted sanctions against the military for both the coup d'etat that they undertook, but also the killing of nearly five dozen pro-democracy protesters, all of whom were unarmed, peaceful protesters. So there really should be consequences if this administration is going to be serious about making human rights and democracy a core pillar of our foreign policy approach, then there have to be consequences when pro-democracy protesters are gunned down in the streets by a military junta, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that, Ambassador Satterfield would be well served to come out and make some very strong messages early on in his tenure.
That was Cameron Hudson, a senior resident fellow with the Atlantic Council's Africa Center in Washington, D.C. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says that a scathing report by an inquiry into state graft marks the end of an era of corruption. But analysts say that it is only the beginning of efforts needed to restore public trust in South Africa's political institutions. Linda Giftash reports from Johannesburg.
For more than 3 years, South Africans watched the public proceeding of a national inquiry into state graft under the tenure of former President Jacob Zuma. That's why its findings of systemic corruption released by Justice Raymond Zondo late Tuesday didn't come as a surprise. Instead, the public is waiting to see what comes next. Narnia Bowler-Muller is a professor with South Africa's Human Sciences Research Council.
Now people want to see consequences and accountability. People are losing trust in government and in democracy. So we don't want to go to a point beyond no return. I do really think that we may be saved by a response that is going to be a proper implementation plan and action. If that doesn't happen, I don't know, you know, then we're not really living in a democracy.
She says public trust in government has been on the decline since 2009, coinciding with Zuma's time in office. The new report focused on corrupt contract tenders and political kickbacks in relation to South African Airways, the State Revenue Agency, and public procurement. It recommended prosecution against former high-ranking lawmakers and their public and private sector affiliates. But charges may not come swiftly. Olwethu Majola, a lawyer and doctoral candidate in criminology at the University of Cape Town, says further investigations need to take place.
We're going to see law enforcement, such as the police or special investigative units, conducting their own investigations based on the preliminary commission, depending on how far or how long it takes investigations to be concluded. Perhaps within, you know, 2 years, we can see charges being brought against an individual.
Majola says the former president will be among those to face prosecution. Zuma was already found guilty of contempt of court last year for failing to appear before the inquiry. He has long denied any wrongdoing and called the inquiry biased. Zuma maintains a loyal following of supporters who don't want to see the former leader imprisoned. In addition to consequences, the inquiry also made recommendations to prevent statecraft, including the formation of an independent corruption agency. Richard Chellen is a senior researcher on organized crime for the Institute for Security Studies in South Africa.
The key question is political interference. How do you create a body that is so independent? How do you fund such a body? Which is very difficult. I think these are the struggles that a lot of the anti-corruption bodies face globally, is how do you maintain independence and who would do the answer to?
The public still has months to wait for any government action. Two more reports from the inquiry will be released in the coming weeks. President Cyril Ramaphosa will then deliver the full report to Parliament by the end of June before implementing its recommendations. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Cameroon has deployed troops and armored cars to towns that will be hosting matches of the Africa Football Cup of Nations, or AFCON tournament, in its troubled southwest region. Cameroon is hosting the continent's top soccer tournament beginning Sunday. But the region's Anglophone separatists have threatened to disrupt the games. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde.
Residents of Cameroon's southwest region towns of Boya and Limbe say in the past 2 weeks there has been a noticeable increase in troops and military trucks on the streets. The troubled southwest region is one area of Cameroon that will be hosting Africa's top soccer championship, the Africa Football Cup of Nations, AFCON. 21-year-old University of Boya student Fabrice Tobi says security in the city is becoming watertight. He spoke to VOA Wednesday via a messaging application.
I was surprised with the amount of armored cars and the troops entering Boya with the ones that were already there. It's very difficult to leave from one area to the other in the city of Boya without meeting military or security man. In markets and even in student residential areas, they are everywhere. They do the control. It's very difficult for you leaving your house without being checked or controlled.
Cameroon's military confirmed that troops have been deployed to Boya and Limbe to protect football players, officials and fans for the tournament. A spokesman declined to comment on the number of troops and armored vehicles deployed. The southwestern towns will host group matches for teams from Gambia, Mali, Mauritania, and Tunisia. Anglophone separatists fighting in Cameroon's west to break away from the majority French-speaking nation have vowed to disrupt the games. Tapang Ivo, a spokesperson for the separatist group Ambazonia Defense Forces, ADF. He says the ADF has warned the Confederation of African Football that AFCON matches should not take place in the towns as the group is still fighting there with government troops.
We vow to fight Cameroon military anywhere they are present in the entire territory of Ambazonia, whether it's during the AFCON games that we've banned or after, we will continue to fight them tooth and nail. So we are avoiding a situation where visitors will be caught in this crossfire. So we are advising that AFCON must not hold in Ambazonia for the security concerns of visitors. They shouldn't be present where there is a war going on.
Within the past 2 months, Boya has reported at least 6 attacks by separatist fighters. The rebels took responsibility for November and December bombings at the University of Boya and the town's Great Sopo Market that wounded at least 14 people. The governor of Cameroon's southwest region, Bernard Okalia Bilai, says civilians should report any rebel suspects hiding in their community.
We have been preparing to make the event historic in the Southwest region. We continue to sensitize the population, particularly towards vigilant. Well, you know what happened in Great Supermarket. It is the population themselves who sees the back and they call the gendarme to come and destroy it. That's the behavior, action we are expecting from the population.
Bilai says residents and visitors should not be afraid of the separatist threats. He says the separatists made similar threats when Limbe and Boya hosted matches of the African Nations Championship a year ago without incident. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Hello. This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Daybreak Africa continues. Nigerian security forces have rescued nearly 100 people, including babies, who were kidnapped and held by armed gangs in the country's northwest Zamfara state. Nigeria police say their release Tuesday was unconditional and that no ransom was paid. While their freedom was welcomed, critics say authorities are not doing enough to improve security in the volatile region. Timothy Obiezu brings us this report from Nigeria.
A total of 97 victims were rescued in two raids carried out by security forces on forest hideouts where local criminal gangs or bandits held them captive. Officials initially liberated 68 captives in the Shinkafi area and later rescued another 29 from a forest hideout elsewhere. Police authorities said the abductees who were rescued include 19 infants between 2 and 7 months old and 16 other children. Pregnant women, nursing mothers, and men were also rescued. Zamfara State's police spokesperson Shehu Mohammed said many of the kidnapped victims had been held for up to 3 months.
On 3rd January 2022, police operatives received an intelligence report that some kidnapped victims were seen stranded in the bush. On receipt of that information, our police operatives, in collaboration with the Genuine Repentant Bandit and Vigilante Group, swung into action.
All the hostages were examined at the state hospital and later handed over to the state government in Gusau, the state capital. Mohammed said they're expected to be reunited with their families later Wednesday. Nigerian police and the army have been cracking down on criminal gangs that attack communities and schools and take away captives, holding them for ransom. Mohammed said a state-led police response on Tuesday evening stopped bandits from attacking another community after a fierce exchange of gunfire. But security expert Kabiru Adamu says such rescue operations are too expensive to maintain.
There is room for improvement. First off, the operations are not sustainable. Nigeria is facing some very difficult economic circumstances. These operations are very expensive, and so they are not likely to, you know, remain for too long. In previous years, such operations have been conducted, but then they would stop them after a while.
Since last year, bandits have increasingly targeted schools, snatching 1,440 students nationwide and some teachers, according to the United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF. In many cases, families had no choice but to pay ransom to recover their loved ones, despite pleas from the government not to pay. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
China's foreign minister arrived in Kenya Wednesday as part of a New Year diplomatic trip to Africa. The foreign minister and Kenyan leaders will discuss a trade deal and Chinese-funded infrastructure projects, which have made the East African nation incur huge debt that some experts say may be difficult to pay. Mohamed Yusuf has more on this story.
Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi met with President Uhuru Kenyatta in Nairobi to discuss trade, infrastructure projects, Kenya's debt, and the security situation in the Horn of Africa. Kenyan diplomacy and international relations expert Kizito Sabala says the foreign minister is mainly looking out for his country's interest in Kenya.
China does not care what other people say, what other countries say, so long as it takes, or so long as the existing regime listens to it. And therefore, in my view, this visit is just meant to enhance Kenya-Chinese relations, of course, being really in favor of China.
According to Kenya's central bank, Chinese money accounts for two-thirds of Kenya's external debt, which has worried economists and the public. Kenya borrowed $50 billion to fund its infrastructure projects in the past few years, and some fear the country's Mombasa port could be given to China to operate if the country defaults on its loans repayment. Wang Yi is expected to visit the port during his visit. Gerishon Ikiara is an international economic affairs lecturer at the University of Nairobi. He questions whether China has more room to negotiate the restructuring of debt.
Now, whether China has any room for reducing it is not very clear. Obviously, it may also consider the implications, because China also is operating on a commercial basis as much as possible. So they will have to weigh those issues of how much concessional measures you can make without necessarily hurting the financial institutions.
Following the global COVID-19 pandemic, which hit African economies, China suspended debt service temporarily, allowing African countries not to pay interest to the borrowed money. In Dakar, Senegal, at the 8th Ministerial Conference of the Forum for China-Africa Cooperation, China pledged to allow African goods worth $300 billion into the country and promised another $10 billion in trade finance to the continent's exports. Sabala says China projects cannot help Kenya develop faster economically.
China being at the level where it is in terms of a very advanced economy, still Kenya relies very much on importing a lot of things from China. That is where the disparity is. Until Kenya begins to export a lot of goods or services to China. And you see, for example, when we get the loans and we invest in the infrastructure, it means really we are not investing in the productive sector that will begin to give results immediately. Infrastructure is very good. It is going to be a long-term investment, but in terms of balancing the trade and so on, it's not going to do that.
Nasongo Miliro teaches international relations at the Technical University in Kenya. He says China is using his country to get to Eastern Africa for economic and security gains.
We have an economic race within the region, and Kenya is just the gateway to Horn of Africa and gateway to East Africa. When Ethiopia was stable, actually Ethiopia was being used. Ethiopia is a child of the Chinese model of trade and military extension.
China's foreign minister will remain in Kenya until Thursday, then wrap up his trip in Comoros on Friday. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voanews.com. We are also on all social media platforms. We are on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Just search for VOA Africa. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good day ahead.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including the House Select Committee's investigation into the January 6th attack on the Capitol is in full force as the U.S. marks 1 year since the deadly riot rocked the nation. Don't miss Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.